Hey, this is Margaret. Thank you for listening to Land and Power from 90.5 WESA. Our friends over at The Confluence continued the conversation about equitable development and affordable housing in Pittsburgh. In the 1950s and 60s, the city's Urban Redevelopment Authority was responsible for executing the urban renewal projects we talked about in Land and Power, the ones that wrought so much destruction in East Liberty and the Hill District. That same agency is now tasked with ensuring equitable development across the city, but it's working with a limited toolbox. One of the URA's more powerful levers is land. In the Hill District, the URA owns hundreds of parcels, and it's aiming to make careful choices about how the revitalization of the main corridor, Center Avenue, takes shape. And housing justice advocates say Pittsburgh is still in crisis when it comes to the shortage of affordable homes. Why is affordable housing so hard to build? We hope you enjoy this bonus episode from 90.5 WESA's The Confluence.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Urban Redevelopment Authority of Pittsburgh is helping homeowners of Larimer improve the roof and facades on their homes. Earlier this month, the mayor and URA officials held a walking tour to show off their work. This walking tour and the work done embodies the role the URA plays in the city. It serves as an investor and, for some, regulator. With us is Diamante Walker, the Deputy Executive Director for the URA. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Diamante, how do you describe your role as an investor in redevelopment and a steward of good development, a regulator?
The way that I think of that, Kevin, is that the URA is tasked with protecting the public's interest. The real goal is to stimulate investment in underinvested neighborhoods in a way that does not spur gentrification. The URA can really only regulate to the extent that we can control the land and wield the economic development incentives.
Mm-hmm. Can those roles, regulator and investor, be at odds at some times?
It may seem like those roles are at odds, but I think that it's really about achieving optimal balance. And I think that, you know, what we've begun to do is to take a human-centered design approach, thinking about the human being within the nucleus of the development that is happening and making people the point and not development the point.
I know that the URA and the Peduto administration have pivoted to focus more on neighborhood investments. That's a big deal. At this point in the city's trajectory, why is that important? And what does it look like in practice?
I think that it is important because in order for a city to really be healthy, all of its residents have to be healthy and have to have a certain quality of life and a standard of living. And so we have to be responsible with our power and with our influence. And when you ask about, well, what does that look like in practice? I think it looks a lot like what we see with the Center Avenue request for qualifications process, or what we refer to as the redevelopment of Center Avenue. We've essentially taken the neighborhood plan, the plan that was designed and imagined by the neighborhood, added some level of technical support and technical expertise to position folks from the neighborhood to begin rebuilding the neighborhood. So these are business owners, these are nonprofit institutions, cultural institutions, and we do that first. We preserve and we stabilize what is already there, and we honor what is there by driving investment towards it. And so the mayor's office has been instrumental in helping us to shift our vision in that direction.
Tell us, what happens when what residents want maybe goes against what could lead to more economic development of a neighborhood?
Residents want what's best for them and their posterity. So one of the biggest problems and the biggest challenges with gentrification is that it portends to make a place more valuable by not already understanding and assuming that the place is valuable because of the existing contributions. So if we change the way that we engage and the way that we value places to honor what is already there, and you have the, you know, very honest and real dialogue with communities and residents about what is possible, what is economically feasible, you know, but understanding that that does not need to be done in a way that sort of supplants culture, I think that is how you get the buy-in from residents and communities. And so part of what you do with economic, equitable economic development is you have those conversations on the front end. And again, you get to those win-win scenarios that put the neighborhood's destiny in the hands of the people who already work there, and you figure out a way to invest in those, and you show and you demonstrate those early viable wins to build that trust.
You've used words, dialogue, conversation, trust. Mm-hmm. When I spoke with Greg Flizram in February, shortly after he became executive director of the URA, mm-hmm. he told the Confluence that he was well aware of skepticism among longtime community members about development and the dearth of low-income housing. What has been done to ease some of that skepticism?
I will again harken back to the Center Avenue redevelopment process. There was a lot of skepticism around that process. Could we actually use publicly owned land to support and direct investment to a neighborhood using the folks who are in that neighborhood? A lot of folks were skeptical and said that maybe it couldn't happen, maybe it wouldn't happen. And so now we are more than a year and a half into this, and we see for the first time in the URA's history, its board voted to advance six proposals, all from minority or neighborhood-driven developers. That is unprecedented in the URA's history. That board vote symbolizes monetary investment, cultural investment, partnership, technical assistance, and that is how you make it real. And so the Center Avenue redevelopment process, and as we talk about avenues of hope, it is about unlocking and unleashing the potential that's already accessible to us in the community.
As you noted, the URA committed to looking at smaller neighborhood investments. Where does that stand right now, particularly with the downturn in the economy?
So the downturn in the economy, we are all experiencing it together. Altruism and you know, having a propensity and policies that want to support equitable economic development are not enough. We need resources. And so, you know, we're not resourced well enough right now to move markets towards equitable development at all costs. I wish that we were. We can push, we can encourage, we can incentivize to a degree, but more resources would really make a difference. So the bright spot in that is that despite the economic downturn that we are facing, the mayor in his budget address, he pledged more than we've seen in the past couple of years, almost triple what we've seen over the last 3 years with respect to commitment to the URA's work. PNC made a $10 million investment earlier this summer. And so that those all, they make a difference, but it is hard, time consuming, expensive work, and it requires resources.
Finally, what tools are you missing to align the city's and the URA's ideas with the realities of the development process?
The biggest tool, I mean, the tool is you know, federal support, support for cities of our size at the federal level to ensure that we can maintain the staffing that we currently have to advance equitable development initiatives. I think that, you know, we've taken a lot of local resources and put it into initiatives like the Neighborhood Investment Fund, which is a tool that is used to support neighborhood scale ideas and to activate economic development activity. Avenues of Hope, I think, will be a tool that can be developed where city planning, DOMI, the URA, the Housing Authority, all of these agencies can convene and coalesce around these areas that have not been invested in and develop a strategic and compelling redevelopment plan that, again, can preserve the culture in a place while improving it for the habitability of future generations.
Diamante Walker is the Deputy Executive Director for the Urban Redevelopment Authority of Pittsburgh. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Affordable housing. It's a term thrown around in local government and neighborhood meetings and until recently on the presidential campaign stage. But affordable housing in Pittsburgh, a city known for cheaper real estate, can be a complicated patchwork for residents. With us is the president and CEO of Bridging the Gap Development, Derek Tillman. Welcome, Derek.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Pittsburgh United's housing justice organizer, Celeste Scott. Celeste, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First off, In 2016, the city's Affordable Housing Task Force found that the city is short roughly 18,000 units of affordable housing. We also know that many of the needed units are those who earn less than 30% of the area median income. Can you give us an update on the housing picture in Pittsburgh? Celeste, we'll start with you.
So as you said, pre-COVID, there was a shortage of over 20,000 affordable units. And now we've still have seen post-COVID that almost that same number of rental households, 22,500, are still at risk of eviction because they can't pay their full rent on time. So we're almost at the same, and it seems like it's worsening.
Right. And Derek, that number that Celeste just quoted is actually higher than the 2016 figures. So what's your take on the current housing picture?
Yeah, without question, you know, there continues to be an affordable housing crisis in the city of Pittsburgh. You know, what really my take is that we have to continue to create, you know, innovative solutions that are, you know, focused on preserving existing affordable housing, but also creating more using the traditional methods, but also through new avenues. You know, it really requires all hands on deck to really move the needle.
Derek, why does it seem like it's difficult to build affordable housing in our area?
I mean, one of the main reasons is it's expensive. And, you know, when you really look at, you know, if you're doing high quality, you know, new construction affordable housing, you can't do it without tax credit. Tax credits are very competitive. You're competing with developers across the entire state of Pennsylvania. And then even with those tax credits, you still need gaps. And the gap financing is what I was referring to. And the gap financing is a scarce resource. So, you know, to really cobble together everything that's needed, it requires a specialized expertise. It requires a commitment that is, you know, not average. You know, it requires a certain level of commitment. And then, you know, it requires, you know, all these components really coming together to make a project like that work.
Celeste, what do you think is standing in the way of meeting the needs of residents?
Okay, for me, I feel like resources are definitely standing in the way of meeting the needs for residents. So we're a big proponent of, like Derek was talking about, preservation. And making sure that the units are safe, quality, and affordable. So habitability has been a big issue. So there are people that, you know, they're living in affordable housing that is subsidized, but it's in terrible quality, you know, terrible condition, and it needs to be rehab. Also, I feel like standing in the way is, you know, communication and outreach and access for people. So there are programs out here that can help people, but if they don't know they exist, then, you know, there's no way for them to be able to access that. And then also, I feel like another big issue is still evictions. Even with the CDC moratorium in place, we're still seeing at least even this week, 144 evictions across 45 magisterial districts. And that's just for this week alone. So, you know, evictions are also a big scourge that we're seeing that is standing in the way of people having, you know, safe, quality, and affordable housing.
Our guests on The Confluence are Celeste Scott from Pittsburgh United and Derek Tillman from Bridging the Gap Development. So the system of creating affordable housing as a percentage of real estate development, is it working or is there a model that would better serve residents of the Pittsburgh area? Celeste, let's start with you.
Sure. I would say as a model, what we've been really looking at as a model is social housing for folks. And that what social housing would be is housing that, you know, has wraparound services for folks. So we're looking at more, you know, social housing models and things like that, where people have housing that also is meeting their social needs. And we're also trying to look at housing that breaks up segregation as well. So having affordable housing in areas historically where there was not, you know, areas like Shadyside and Squirrel Hill, and making sure that people do have equal fair housing access. So those are, you know, two other models that are really important, I think, that would work, I think, better mm-hmm. than what we're seeing now. We're seeing a lot of, you know, need for more deeply affordable housing stock. Particularly, we're seeing we need more, you know, families with children, so more 2 and 3 bedrooms that are deeply affordable for folks. that seems to be lacking. So those are just a few of the things that we've been looking at as better models.
Derek, what about you? Is there a model that would better serve residents of the area?
I think the model that exists is making a difference, but we need more. I wouldn't necessarily throw out the existing model. It's what can we add to it so that we have almost like a smorgasbord of options. I agree with Celeste that we can't just focus on building housing. We have to also be focused on building people through supportive services and things of that nature. So yes, we need to create affordable housing in, amenity-rich type areas, that are more, mixed income, but also in our traditional low-income areas, we need to create more mixed income. So even having some more market rate in those areas in conjunction with creating more affordable units. So I think we actually need both ends of the spectrum. The existing programs utilizing low-income housing tax credits, I think, is highly effective. That's been proven. But I also think we need to be doing some more rehabbing in addition to that, not to kind of throw out the traditional. But I think if we look at all of these different things combined, so we need more resources focused over here, as well as more resources for the traditional method. So I think it's more about resources than if it's working or not.
What could city and county officials be doing to support developers more who want to build more inclusive housing? Derek?
I think one thing city can do, which won't cause any cost any more money, is accelerated processing for affordable housing. Accelerated processing through the zoning process, through city planning process, through just really all the permitting processes to advance affordable housing, to our city.
So, what would success in addressing the need for affordable housing look like to each of you? Celeste, we're going to start with you.
For me, it would look like, actual residents, having safe quality and affordable housing and be able to thrive. We've been getting so many horrific calls, of people, literally women with children, a lot of Black women with children, being evicted, living in their cars, just horrific situations with people. This was pre-COVID and, currently now. So for me, it looks like people, being able to thrive, having housing choice. Living in safe quality, affordable housing, and being able, to live their best lives, and dignified lives. So that's what success would look like for me.
Derek, what does success look like for you in addressing the need for affordable housing?
Success for me in addressing affordable housing really is measured in moving the needle down substantially as it relates to our gap, our unit need in the region. It also incorporates and looks at this from a fair housing lens. So making sure that the fair housing methodology is incorporated into every single facet and every single decision being made. It includes sustainable development components, which I think is even more important during and post-COVID, to incorporate sustainable design and energy efficient measures that add to an overall healthier space. And that is affordable, that meets the needs of families, that really, give them pride and a sense of a place that they call home.
Derek Tillman is president and CEO of Bridging the Gap Development, and Celeste Scott is Pittsburgh United's housing justice organizer. Thanks to each of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. Stay tuned following the Marketplace Tech Report. It's the final episode of the podcast, Land and Power. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.